Ms. Chalupka, good morning.
Good morning, Chief Justice Havokin, and may it please the Court. My name is Marin Lynn Chalupka. I represent Manuela Domingo, who is the mother of and the personal representative of the estate of Efren Domingo. We thank the Court for hearing this case. This is the second appeal of this case since it was filed in 2007. I am here today because, as the poem says, I have promises to keep. Manuela's son, Efren, would be 23 today. 10 years ago, a Union Pacific train hit him and killed him. Two sets of tracks run east and west through the middle of the town of Schuyler, and they intersect the B Street crossing right by the school. Efren and his two younger cousins, Roger and Alex, were riding home on bikes, and they were on the south side of the crossing, south of the south track. They were facing north, and they stopped because a train was crossing going from west to east on the south tracks. That eastbound train was between Efren and the north tracks. There's no way to see what's on the north tracks if a train is on the south tracks. You cannot see through a freight train. So if a westbound train is approaching the crossing on the north tracks, the engineer of that westbound train has got to give warning that he's coming. The way you do that is blow the horn. 15 seconds before you get to the crossing and keep blowing it until you clear the crossing. Keep blowing it because when another freight train is blasting through the same crossing at the same time and you're both doing 60 miles per hour, it's not reasonable to think that a child can distinguish between the rumble and the clatter of your approaching train versus the rumble and the clatter of a departing train.
Are there crossing gates?
There are. There are at the vehicle part of the crossing. There's a pedestrian crossing to the side, which does not have crossing gates.
And where was the decedent?
The decedent had stopped at the crossing, and there's a dispute as to where he was, whether he was at the crossing, the pedestrian crossing. There's been differing accounts. And we're certainly going to acknowledge that the gates were down when he went onto the tracks. I have no problem acknowledging that, Justice Castle.
Did the other two boys cross the tracks after the eastbound train had gone through?
The other two boys, their affidavits are in the record, Chief Justice Havokin. Roger and Alex both testified that they had moved to the right of the crossing and they saw Efren enter the crossing and get hit.
Let me ask you again, did they cross after the eastbound train went through?
They crossed after the eastbound train went through. I don't think that they did, Chief Justice Havokin, if I'm understanding your question correctly.
So you're saying they crossed before the eastbound train got there?
I'm saying I don't think that they crossed. From my understanding from their affidavit testimony, that they watched the collision happen.
They never crossed the tracks at all?
That they had waited with Efren. Efren entered the crossing and Efren was hit.
Now the engineer admits that he didn't blow the horn for the full 15 seconds, doesn't he?
The engineer denies that. The engineer claims that he did blow it in compliance with everything. Our railroad safety consultant, Charles Culver, looked at Union Pacific's own report on the event recorder download. He says that he did not. He blew it for 12 seconds.
And the engineer didn't even remember that there was an eastbound train passing at the crossing, did he?
In fact, Justice Wright, the engineer denied that there was an eastbound train. The conductor denied that there was an eastbound train. And in other words, to believe them, you would have to think that Efren could see one and only one train coming, have no visual obstructions whatsoever, and still decided to ride into the intersection. So, now, this is significant because essentially what that means is that they made an entire freight train disappear. This case has gone on for so long that Union Pacific forgot that they had admitted in written discovery responses that there was an eastbound, or that there was an eastbound train.
And the conductor testified that he made eye contact with the decedent?
Claimed that he made eye contact with Efrain Domingo, and yet the event recorder report shows that at the time of impact, at the moment of impact, the train was throttling up. He was accelerating.
The other boys, were riding their bikes, is that correct?
Yes.
Was Efrain on a bike?
Yes, all on bicycles.
And when he was struck, was he on a bike?
Yes, Your Honor. All on bicycles.
So, so he wouldn't be a pedestrian?
He wouldn't be a pedestrian. He also wouldn't be a car. Yeah. He'd be the two-wheeled variety in between.
So is your factual issue that if the engineer had properly done what he was supposed to do with regard to the horn, that this accident may not have happened?
That
was approximate cause?
Yes.
It was a failure to blow the horn.
Did you plead that?
Did we plead that? I believe that we did, Chief Justice Hebekin. It certainly was in the affidavit testimony of Mr. Culver that was submitted and received by the district. It certainly was in there. There was two major problems with the district court's very scant and very imprecise reasoning. First was that it completely, well, and both of them come down to the same thing. There's absolutely no acknowledgement that she looked at any of the opinions of Mr. Culver. None. No acknowledgement.
Well, what duties do you think that the railroad violated? In other words, what horse are you riding here? What's the duty they violated?
I think I can break that into two responses or two half responses, Chief Justice Hebekin. The first is the failure to blow the horn, compliance with the federal regulations and also in compliance with Union Pacific's general operating rules.
You think you pled that?
And I'm sorry?
And you think you pled that?
I don't know that we needed to specifically plead that, Your Honor. I think we pled negligence, and this would be one of the means in which they were negligent. But the other half of this answer goes to the visibility. And this court has held in the Anderson versus Union Pacific case that when there is visibility obstructions and when there's something unusual about the crossing, a railroad needs to take extra safety precautions, such as lowering the speed, such as making sure that visual obstructions...
What's unusual about this crossing?
What's unusual about this crossing is the confluence of two trains crossing each other at allowable speeds of 60 miles per hour.
And the cases you cited in your brief were those cases where trains were parked and blocking?
Correct.
Right.
That's correct.
So you think that the railroad has a duty to coordinate its trains at every crossing?
I don't, but they might want to reduce the speed below 60 miles an hour in the middle of town when there's an intersection next to a school.
So did you plead speed? Is that, are you saying there's a third component to this?
We pled general negligence, Your Honor. I don't recall whether we had actually parsed out each level of each type of negligence. We pled generally negligence and notice pleadings.
What evidence is in the record that suggested that speed had anything to do with this?
I don't think the speed itself necessarily had something to do with it, other than that it would have been appropriate to slow down, it would have been appropriate to take extra precautions. What we had in this situation was a crossing at a school with a pedestrian crossing next to it. In other words, notice to Union Pacific that this is a crossing that's going to be used by more than just the occasional car, right through the middle of town.
Well, I'm assuming you had a freight train here that was probably 100 cars long anyway.
Correct.
And as the eastbound train passed, there was about 2 or 3 seconds before the westbound train reached the intersection?
I want to address that, actually, Justice Wright. The claim was made by Union Pacific that there were 7 seconds from the time that the eastbound train cleared the crossing. From the affidavit of our railroad safety expert, Charles Culver, that is not the standard for visibility for the court to have focused on. The standard for visibility is from the time that the eastbound train cleared the locomotive of the westbound train. That's different. In other words, making sure that the eastbound train is no longer obstructing any part of the westbound train. It's not when they clear the crossing. When they clear the crossing, there's still 100 cars or more of the eastbound train that are between anything that you can see off to this direction.
Well, my point is, sound made by the eastbound train after it cleared the crossing would not be the same sound that the westbound train would make as it's entering the crossing because the diesel's horn would be blowing.
I don't know that there's any evidence that a 13-year-old boy would know the difference, but he would know what a horn is.
The horn's speed is 60 miles per hour, the train going west on the north track. Was that in violation of any regulation, ordinance, or statute?
No.
So you're not alleging that speed is the cause here?
I'm not in any sense other than it's a factor that would warrant extra safety precautions given the location of this.
Then what I hear, correct me if I'm wrong, your position is there's a question of fact on whether the engineer or the conductor sounded the horn.
May I answer, Your Honor?
Sure.
There is a question of fact on whether he sounded the horn that 3 seconds and 300 feet passed, according to UP's own report on his event recorder, with no horn, at the time that another train was going through and would mask the sound of the oncoming train and mask the visibility of the oncoming train. I hate the cliche perfect storm, but that's what happened, and that's what got Efrain killed.
And you're relying on federal regulations for that?
Federal regulations and Union Pacific's own general operating code. And the affidavit of our railroad safety expert, which goes through the event recorder download, which goes through those regulations, was received by the district court, wasn't even mentioned in her reasoning.
Well, because the fact that the engineer and the conductor denied there was a westbound train, is that also a question of fact?
Sure, it sure as hell is. Because we have three witnesses who say there were. We have Jim Grealis, who is the claims rep that persuaded Manuela to sign a release 45 hours after Efrain's death. He testified that there was a westbound train from his investigation. And Union Pacific admitted it in their own written discovery.
Well, we know there was a westbound train because that's what struck.
Or, I mean, eastbound train.
You know there's a... Okay.
Two trains. We'll just go with two trains for simplicity. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Novotny, good morning.
Good morning, members of the court. My name is Mark Novotny. I'm here from Lamson, Dugan, Murray on behalf of Union Pacific. Let me address a couple of the things that the court brought up just a few moments ago. And I want to rely on the record, make sure the record is very clear. The picture of the track that was up, there's no measurements. That is just Mr. Culver's estimation based on what he heard and saw. He never measured anything. It's a freehand drawing. No dispute as to where he was. The only evidence in this record is the conductor as to where Mr. Efrain Domingo was the conductor indicated that at the time he approached the intersection, he saw Mr. Domingo on the left-hand side of the track. The conductor sits on the left side of the cab. He saw him there. He saw him there.
But isn't that interesting that he could see the little boy, but he couldn't see the eastbound train?
Your Honor, I think that's a very important question. I think counsel's wrong when she indicates that the conductor and the engineer denied seeing the train. If you look at exhibits 90 and 91, at pages 30 to 32 of both of those exhibits, they say, and they were both asked interestingly three times on those pages, three times each, do you remember the train? And they're saying, I don't remember. I just don't remember. They're not saying it didn't happen. They're saying, I don't remember. Their depositions were taken almost 8 years after the event.
Well, they don't remember. Probably a red herring anyway. About whether what their memory is and what their credibility is, but what about the fact that was there an issue of fact as to whether or not the engineer blew the horn for a full 15 seconds prior to entry of the crossing area and blew the horn through the crossing area? It wouldn't make any difference, I guess, if he blew it after he got past the crossing area, but before that, was there an issue of fact as to whether he actually did blow the horn for the required time?
I would rely on the record, Your Honor. The record indicates the only admitted evidence at the summary judgment hearing was the testimony of the conductor and engineer, who both said that the engineer followed the correct pattern, blew the horn as was required, and used a sequencer, a foot pedal, to require it to do the two.
I thought there was evidence that there was about 2 or 3 seconds that the horn wasn't blowing before he got to the crossing.
That evidence was never admitted to evidence, Your Honor. That was the event recorder and the report of Bob Owens from Union Pacific. Judge Gilbride did not admit that into evidence, and counsel arguing that is something that's outside the record, Your Honor. The only evidence we have is the two trainmen indicated the horn was sounded appropriately. If the court would like me to address the evidence that was not admitted, I can certainly do that. But that was not...
Why don't you do that? What difference does that make?
Thank you, Your Honor. The evidence was that for 15 seconds prior to the impact, 12 seconds of it, the engineer blew the horn. And if the court were to look at those, at that information, in the 15 seconds before the impact, the event recorder records that the horn is blown 7 times in 15 seconds, more than once every 2 seconds. In the 33 seconds before impact, the unadmitted evidence indicates in the 33 seconds it was blown 13 times in the 33 seconds, 2.5 times per second. That's what the evidence would be if it were admitted, Your Honors. And also, Mr. Culver indicates, and counsel indicates, that the requirement is that the whistle be blown for 15 consecutive seconds. That's not the way Union Pacific reads that regulation 2221. That regulation indicates it must start 15 seconds before, and then you do your pattern. And again, Mr. Culver indicated his affidavit, the engineer indicated his affidavit, you push a pedal, and a sequencer makes sure that the too long, one short, too long happens. It avoids the error of people saying, gee, it's my horn long enough. And the engineer testified he did blow the horn that way. The conductor said he did blow the horn that way, and that's the only evidence we have. So, Your Honors, I think that the issue of the horn is truly a red herring. And I think another thing to bring out, as Justice Helke, I think you asked, that was never brought up in the pleadings. There was never an allegation of failure to blow the horn correctly.
Does there have to be?
I think, Your Honor, that's your discretion to see if the allegations of general negligence are enough. We live in a notice pleading state. I think that's at the discretion of the court. I don't think it has to be, Your Honor, no. In summary, on that point, Your Honor, there is no evidence, not a genuine issue of material fact, there is no evidence admitted before the trial court that the horn was blown inappropriately. None. Zero. A couple more points the court asked questions about. Speed. The first time we've heard about speed is today, Your Honor. There's never been briefed, signs there, or indicated something that Union Pacific did wrong. The Anderson case, counsel mentioned the Anderson case. It's important to note that the Anderson case is a case where there were no gates, no bells, no lights, unlike this crossing. And in that case, as one of the justices, I don't remember which one of you did, pointed out, there was a train obstructing, a solitary train obstructing.
Well, but the eastbound train going would trigger the gates, and those gates wouldn't rise until the eastbound train was a certain distance past the crossing. So it isn't like they're going to rise and come back down when the westbound train comes. They're still down from the east train because that was the first train that got there.
Excellent point, Your Honor, and I think the issue of that is clear again. The only evidence we have in this record, which we have to decide the case on, is the conductor says, I was able to see the intersection, the crossing, and the cars to the left 5 to 6 seconds before the impact.
Of course he can. He's 15 feet higher than the person on the ground.
Certainly, Your Honor.
But what about the person on the ground? What can they see?
There is no evidence submitted by the appellant in that regard.
Help me out here. Did the other boys, did they clear the north track?
Thank you, Your Honor. Excellent point again. The only evidence of the record is the engineer testified, Mr. Russell testified that they had cleared the track.
The north track.
The north track. Both tracks.
Both tracks. Yeah. And the deceased, he was on his bicycle when he was struck?
Yes, Your Honor. His feet were down, but he was on the bicycle.
They had that small little window of time from the time the east train cleared the tracks and the west train reached the crossing.
Yes, Your Honor.
They had 1 or 2 seconds to make it.
Well, the engineer testified 5 to 6 seconds that he could see that the train had cleared. The eastbound train had cleared the track enough that he could see the crossing before the westbound train got to the crossing. And the point about the bicycle is very important. As we put in our brief, Your Honors, in this case, bicycles are to follow the rules of the road. There are no time or age restrictions on bicycles. And the rules of the road in Nebraska require that you stop 15 to 50 feet from that intersection, and you don't go around the gates.
Well, if you were the engineer of the train and you saw two people reaching their safety requirements by crossing in front of you when you're only 5 seconds away, would it be reasonable that the engineer would start sounding the horn to make sure that no one else tried to do that?
Important point, Your Honor, you're correct. If you believe the unadmitted evidence...
Well, I believe the engineer said he saw the kid. She saw two of them across 5 seconds away. If you were an engineer and you saw that, wouldn't you lay on the horn?
He did, Your Honor. The unadmitted evidence indicated up to 3 seconds away he was on the horn. So he was on the horn.
But then for 3 seconds he wasn't?
And, Your Honor, there's nothing in the record to reflect this, but I suggest to you there's a time deadline in between the conductor saying, bust him, which is the comment to hit the emergency brake, and him reaching the emergency brake and registering.
Does the engineer have an override on the horn that if he wants that horn to blast solid all the way through, he can do that without getting into your two longs and a short and a long?
Not in the record, but I can tell you, Your Honor, absolutely.
So he can override that?
Absolutely, but the key also here is...
When he saw the two kids cross in front of him, wouldn't he be required to lay on the horn all the way through that crossing?
I have a problem with the word required. Would it be prudent? Would it be a good idea? Sure, it'd be a good idea. But also, Your Honor, you got to realize there are some 200 crossings across
the crossing. What else could he do? Hitting the brakes was ridiculous. You can't stop a quarter of a mile freight train in less than, half a mile?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So... Didn't make any difference. He could have been drunk driving that train, and the brakes wouldn't make any difference.
And there's no evidence that if he would hit the horn, it made a difference in the case.
Was there evidence that he saw two people cross the train in violation of the signal, and was there evidence that the horn wasn't blowing for 3 seconds before the collision?
There's evidence that he saw the people crossing, and there is no admitted evidence. There is no evidence in this record that he was not blowing the horn.
Is there evidence that he had eye contact with the kid?
He mean the engineer?
With the deceased?
He mean the engineer, Your Honor?
Well, one of the
conductor, absolutely. There is uncontroverted evidence that the young man looked at the conductor in the eye and then chose to go across. After he had gone around the gates, ignored the bell, ignored the lights, and all the stop traffic. Absolutely, Your Honor.
There is no assignment of error regarding admission of evidence or... rejection of evidence.
The appellant has not assigned any error in that regard. So the evidence is the conductor and engineer said the horn was sounded appropriately. And that's the only evidence that the trial court considered. I see I'm out of time, Your Honors. We've been here before. We asked the court to consider the admitted evidence in this case. And the admitted evidence shows that there was no genuine material fact and that the trial court properly granted summary judgment. We ask you to affirm that. There's no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
He is over.
There is no time for rebuttal. We will go on to the next case of the day, which is State versus Eric M. Henry. Judge Moore, the Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals, will join the court for this case. So. Good morning, Mr. Sipple, but let's give everybody a little bit of time to get in and out of the courtroom.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Justice Miller-Lerman has rejoined the court.